We're in for a real treat tonight. We have Mr. Alistair Gray, who's joined us, and a very well-respected homeopathic educator and practitioner. Mr. Gray has been practicing general natural medicine in Sydney, Australia, and in New Zealand for the last 14 years. In New Zealand, he lectures at the Bay of Plenty College and the Wellington College of Homeopathy, and in Australia at the Sydney College of Homeopathic Medicine, the Australasian College of Natural Therapies, and the Nature Care College in Sydney. He's also a regular seminar presenter in Kuala Lumpur for the Homeopathic Academy Council of Malaysia, and he holds their PCHOM. Alistair has also regularly presented and lectured in Toronto, Canada, Boulder, I think for Barbara Seidnick at the Colorado Institute, also San Francisco, Galway, Ireland, Preston, Nottingham, England, and Bangkok, Thailand. He was trained in the UK at the School of Homeopathy, and he completed his postgraduate work with Jeremy Scher at the Dynamis School in London. He's got a grounding in homeopathy, plus a diverse background in many other areas, and a fascination specifically in medical and homeopathic history. He's also a body worker, has a background in Gestalt therapy. He integrates all these different methodologies into his practice and teaching of homeopathy, and as well, he's a publisher of a number of different homeopathic provings, including Agathis australis, the white-tailed spider, box jellyfish, the tea tree, licorice, cockroach, toad, seahorse, cactus, pearl, mosquito, tar tree, and many others. And we're very honored, and really it's our pleasure to welcome you to the call this evening. Thank you for joining us.
It's an absolute pleasure. It's good to talk to the folks in the States, especially. At this time, you'll be having cups of tea and getting into a beer and having your dinner, I suppose.
That's it. So, Alistair, can you tell us a little bit about your background? How did you get involved in homeopathy, and what led you to this science and art?
I think for me, it's a similar story to many folks that get caught up in homeopathy, and I had a pretty spectacular cure of my lifelong hay fever symptoms when I was in my early 20s, and I took myself off to a very, very strange woman in New Zealand where I was living, and she asked me all sorts of outrageous questions, and I had no idea about what she was doing, and she gave me she went into a cupboard and did something, and she gave me a little white pill, and touch wood, I haven't ever sneezed again.
Wow.
And that was a pretty powerful experience at a time where, you know, I'd been studying at university and wasn't quite sure what direction to take, and that experience was a very, you know, kind of visceral, powerful thing to happen at that young age, I think.
Mm. What happened? You started getting, did you start going to school, or where did it go from there?
Well, it's a funny old thing, really, because as I said, I was in New Zealand, and I remember at the time looking around at the options in New Zealand for training in homeopathy. I actually wrote to Vifilcus. the mid 80s, and I wrote him a letter, and he wrote back and said, "Thank you very much, but no, we're not interested." And then I wrote to different colleges and in Australia, and then I ended up just hitting it off with Misha Norland in the UK. And I wasn't necessarily tied to New Zealand at that time or that age, so I took myself off to England. I did my first year by distance, and then I went, I moved and headed over and attended Mission Orleans College in Devon, in England. It was just fantastic.
Mm-hmm. That's great. Yeah, a lot of really top-notch homeopaths have come out of that school, that's for sure.
Yeah, it's really interesting because I was reflecting on it because I was I often, you know, stand in front of a bunch of first-year students or second-year students and think about how different it is today. You know, later today I'm going down into Sydney, and the college, one of the colleges I teach at is, you know, it's right by a central railway station, and there's 1,000, you know, people running around, and everyone's stressed, and all the students have got coffee on their table, and they've run, you know, from the trains and all the rest of it. And when I was studying, you know, at college, we sat around on beanbags, and we sat on meditation stools and listened to Beethoven, and it was a very different learning experience going to that college in the countryside in England.
Interesting. So, you know, I know, you know, different practitioners and teachers have different focuses and different areas of homeopathy. Some people, you know, are very interested in working with miasms. Other people are really interested in, you know, Boninghausen or, you know, what they call classical homeopathy, or Jeremy's done a lot of work with proving. I'm curious, do you have a particular area of focus in your teaching and research?
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, I do. I suppose there's a few of them, however. The one that comes to mind, I mean, this morning, you know, it's midday here, it's 11 o'clock here in the morning, and I've seen a couple of clients this morning, and the clients that I attract, and I'm still not quite sure why, I attract a lot of men. And I'm consistently seeing far more male patients than any of my colleagues. Natural medicine and homeopathy in particular, I reckon, it attracts mainly women. And I think at the moment I'm running about 50-50% in my practice.
Incredible.
So I do see a lot of male patients and a lot of men who are in the corporate world or who, you know, would not normally be attracted to something as kind of kooky as homeopathy. So definitely that's a focus for me, and that's just something that's emerged over the years, and I've, you know, taken that and lectured on it in different places around the world, and I've got a few ideas about, you know, how we progress. So that's one focus for me. I've done a lot of work on anxiety and depression, specifically. So those are areas in which I've spent a deal of time researching, and a lot of patients have come my way. The other area that I seem to attract, it's very strange really, is people that are wrestling with recreational drug use. And very often into my practice walk younger folks who are really wrestling with recreational drug use and looking for a natural option to get over their problems.
I think the problem is, the reason we're hearing some background noise is I had to unmute you because I believe that you use the caller PIN number. So the person who's speaking, can you hear me? Could you please, because I have the lines unmuted at the moment.
Hello?
Yes, we can hear you. So if you could just not speak, we would really, really appreciate that. Okay, thank you very much. Sorry about that, Alistair.
That's no problem at all.
Yeah.
It's interesting you mentioned miasms and miasmatic theory and Boninghausen and those things. And definitely, you know, my focus of my work is clinically is definitely orientated towards the work of Boninghausen these days. I found it so useful in my clinic to retrain myself as to how to use that method. And then the other focus of my work is definitely research and researching into especially new remedies and reproving old remedies.
Mm-hmm. Could you tell us
those
a little bit about? I know you've done a lot of work on provings. You've done how many remedies have you actually proven now so far?
Well, I mean, I've been involved in proving at least 25 remedies and coordinating maybe 22 of those, and I've written. That's not quite true. There's still three to be that I'm working on at the moment, but there's about 19 or 20 of them that have been published.
Mm. Could you tell us a little bit of that? I've actually done some proving for myself in Japan. It's an amazing process, and you know, I know people have different approaches. I'm curious, what is specifically your approach? Do you use double-blind, mass placebo clinical trials? Do you have a supervisor for each person? What exactly? How do you run your provings, basically?
Yeah, sure. So look, I did my study with Jeremy Scher, and as you're aware, that the renaissance of the homeopathic proving has really come from him, from the 90s through to now. And so when I began, the first time I ever came across a proving was, I did his proving of plutonium. I took plutonium nitricum in whatever it was, 1994, maybe 93. And, you know, that was a pretty powerful experience.
I can imagine.
And every now and again, I glow in the dark, you know. It's quite useful sometimes. But I also did Misha Norlin's proving of AIDS as well, and he's obviously written that one up as a useful piece of literature for us. But for me, I was heavily influenced by Jeremy's ideas. And I just, you know, I was in the right place at the right time. When I got to Australia and started living here in 96, I pretty much as soon as I hit the ground, I was asked to teach a course at one of the colleges here on proving method. And, of course, you know, I did what I thought was the right thing to do and just taught them Jeremy's, you know, fantastic book on proving method and started doing it in that way. And, of course, you know, he takes a pretty liberal line when it comes to the use of placebo and whether it's blind or double blind. You know, he argues for and against those two, you know, those two extremes. So I've done my early provings were done. Some of them were done with a few placebos, a few participants getting placebo, and of course they hate it when they find out after doing all of this work for weeks and weeks and writing down their symptoms. You know, it's a very awkward conversation to sit in front of a really, really diligent prover and then tell them, sorry, you know, you got the placebo. I've copped a bit of flack from their point of view. So that's the placebos. I mean, and as far as I'm aware, the jury's still out on that. When it comes to blinding, I had a very difficult proving experience once with the proving of mosquito, the New Zealand mosquito, where some of the provers absolutely lost the plot in the first 3 days of taking that remedy. And I found myself in a very – do you understand what I mean by losing the plot?
No. Can you explain what you mean by that? I'm not familiar.
They struggled very, very, very seriously with some powerful symptoms that were debilitating, especially mentally and emotionally. And I had the same experience with another one, actually, white-tailed spider, where some provers, maybe some vulnerable provers, went into some pretty deep psychological states. Both of those provings were done double blind. I had no idea what they were, and I found it very difficult to deal with that as a coordinator and a supervisor, and also ethically responsible for them to be able to look after them as best as I could as they were going through their proving experience. Of course, they're students as well, and I'm working for a college, and that lends another whole layer of ethics and research on top of that. So anyway, the point is that I'm trying to make is that I must admit I've pulled back from necessarily being an advocate of doing double-blind homeopathic provings, because I can see that there's use in the coordinator knowing what that substance is and being able to deal with a prover that's having a really miserable time.
Very interesting.
I think, and then Paul Hirsky produced those two books on provings. When was that? Maybe in the early 2000s, I think?
About 4 or 5 years ago.
Yeah, and I must admit, he said a couple of things that really struck a chord with me. And if we get into some of those issues, I mean, one of the problems with... he took Jeremy Sher to task about that idea that every prover is sensitive.
Right.
And every prover comes up with symptoms. And I must admit, I really reflected on that and thought about it a lot. And so I've integrated just a couple of Paul Hirsky's points.
Whoever's pushing the buttons on the keyboard, please. Thank you. Sorry, Alistair.
Yeah, no, you're right. I've just integrated a couple of points that Paul Hirsky raised in his book in response to Jeremy Sher's method. And for me, I like what he says about not every prover is sensitive, and we've got to understand that their baseline of health and, if you like, their constitutional type. That makes a bit of sense to me.
Right.
I also really like what he says. You know, he says that it's crucial to get an understanding of the chronology of a proving, of how a remedy washes through a person, the primary and secondary action.
Sure.
And so as a consequence of that really obvious thought, I do two things when I write up a proving. I give everyone what Jeremy Sher does or what, say, Vermeulen does, and that's, you know, the proving information from mind through to throat, through to generalities. But then I also give them each individual prover's chronology so that you can read a proving and really see how it washes through someone, primary and secondary action. I think those were two well-made points, at least from Hirsky.
I agree.
So, sorry, go.
Yeah, no, I agree. I think those were very, very good points that he made.
Mm.
Yeah.
And, of course, there's one other controversial part of Jeremy's provings, and that is he uses the same prover over and over and over again.
Right.
It's an interesting issue, that one, because, of course, Hahnemann did it as well.
Sure.
He proved most of his remedies, obviously, and Nanning and Langhammer and all of those, and Stapp, you know, they were all involved in maybe 20 or more of his provings. I think Nanning might have done 40 or something. And of course, they keep coming up with the same symptoms. And I just think there's a philosophical argument for us all to have at some point, maybe in the next year or two, just about what we think about having one person who's very sensitive participating over and over again in provings.
Yeah. Yeah, you're right. It's a very interesting subject that needs quite a bit of discussion and dialogue, for sure.
I reckon Richard Pitt would be one to involved in that conversation. And
yeah, actually, Richard's most, I think, recent issue of his journal was dedicated to provings. Did you see that, by Alistair?
Yeah, I put in the four books that I've written. I submitted to Richard for that for his journal. I submitted the introductions of my four books just because they kind of discuss these issues.
Mm. Right. So, Alistair, I'm curious. What you've obviously used some of the remedies that you've proven in your own practice. Can you share perhaps some of the more memorable remedies that you've proven that you found to be useful clinically?
Look, the two that I've had the best success with, without a doubt, is Culex, and that's Culex pervigilans, which is the New Zealand mosquito. When I did that proving, I of course had neglected to remember that Kent had done a proving and had written in his lesser writings about it. Presumably, his Culex, I think it's Culex musca, was an American mosquito. So when I compared what the Sydney students came up with in 2002 with what he came up with, I was just stunned that I think of his 56 symptoms, there was something like 36 were word for word. I mean, it was extraordinary, the overlap. It wasn't, there are some throat symptoms. It was lips swelling on the left side, like incredible overlap of provings that are 100 years apart.
Mm.
So that was the first striking thing about that remedy. And then since then, I've just had some really great cases helping people with Culex in particular, with allergic reactions, helping folks with problems, especially of the lips. And if you marry the information, the proving information, with what Rajan and Divya and Sudhir say about the insect family, you know, if you start to look at the qualities of the insect family and then specifically look at the proving symptoms that came out of Culex, I've had some really good hits with people that are violent, they're with overt sexual behavior, and it's pretty colorful cases.
Mm.
Not all of them, unfortunately, on video, but I've got some, very good responses from that.
Mm. And are these cases remedy published now, Alistair?
Look, I try and drip them out as much as I can. For example, is it Joni in California? Just recently wrote to me and said that she'd had a really good result with Moreton Bay fig. Mm. Francis Treuherz, the collector and historian in England, has written and saying he's had really good results with Moreton Bay fig. And every now and again I get an email from some homeopath around the world saying, oh, look, I've prescribed this remedy. And so what I try and do is just over time get that information out to validate and verify some of those proving symptoms. Proving assertions, I suppose.
Right.
You know, we've got a problem in homeopathy, and that's that people publish things far too quickly, and they make assertions about things far too quickly, without a lot of evidence. This is just an opinion I have, and do you agree?
Well, yeah. I mean, you look at Hahnemann. It took him 12 years. He worked on the theory of the miasms for 12 years before sharing it with Gross and staff. You know, his closest students, and I think he did that because he wanted to make sure that he wasn't jumping the gun, that what he was saying was based on lots of clinical confirmation. Yeah,
well,
I think that is lacking in certain areas in our community, for sure.
Well, I think so. I mean, for me, that's just exactly my point. You know, I look around and there's a lot of provings that have been published and a lot of assertions about, what's the center of this proving or what's this remedy about, within, 10 minutes of it being published. And for me, that we have to be very careful of that quick publication or quick assertion of what, the essence or the center or the genius of a remedy is.
Sure,
and
sure.
I prefer that over a period of decades, we get familiar with new remedies based on evidence, based on cured cases in the clinical verification.
Sure.
Mm.
Alistair, you mentioned there was another remedy as well that you've had some clinical experience with and success.
The other one I've had is white-tailed spider.
Uh-huh.
And that's approving maybe 2000, I can't remember. Funny old thing, in Australia and New Zealand, there are these little critters. You know, Australia's just teeming full of things that will kill you. And white-tailed spider won't kill you, but it's got this reputation of creating pretty bad ulcers that won't heal. Louis Klein has written about brown recluse in the States, hasn't he?
Yeah.
That's right, okay. And so while brown recluse, there's definite scientific evidence that it can create those ulcers that won't heal. In Australia, the jury's still out about whether the white-tailed spider does the same thing. And so every now and again, you get a client coming in saying, look, I got bitten by this spider, you know, 2 weeks ago or 2 years ago. You know, can you help me? And so it became really obvious that it was time to do a proving of that remedy. The scientific community is really split as to whether that spider actually creates those wounds or not.
Mm.
So there's that a little bit of controversy there. But nevertheless, I've had some really solid results with bad skin complaints, ulcers. And in that proving, gee, the strangest things came out. One of the strongest symptoms was the sensation that someone is doing voodoo on me.
Wow.
This was a prover that had that strong paranoia. And I've just had some great verification of that particular symptom over the years. Mm. Also, pretty amusingly, there was a desire to clean the house, a desire... Mm. And for those men and women that...
Yeah, I was going to say, you know, don't try to give this to your intimate partner because...
But I've given it to people for whom it's a real problem, and it's just been magic.
That's great.
So, look, every now and again, I've had some nice results. The proving of box jellyfish, that's an evil creature that... creates miserable symptoms and kills you pretty quickly. I've had some lovely results in the clinic with box jellyfish.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, this is such a great contribution you're making doing this work. It's and 25 provings is a lot of work.
Well, I think it is actually. If you know, when you start writing up provings, you realize the amount of work that's involved, and especially the creation of rubrics. My God, difficult is that?
Yeah, for sure.
And you know, it's a responsible job, and you've got to do it well and conservatively, in my opinion.
Right.
But there's just one other point about those provings, and that while I think it's important that we do provings of exciting new remedies, the thing that's given me the most satisfaction, and actually a lot of my students as well, is the reproving of poorly previously proven remedies, and especially to give clinical verification or verification of the whole proving science, really. I think that's a really important thing that we do. That we don't just get caught up with doing provings of the latest, you know, milk from whatever bizarre creature.
Sure.
That we just go back and we do a reproving of phosphorus, or we reprove something that, like bufo, for example, or cactus. You know, those traditional remedies that when you look, actually, the provings, they're a little bit dodgy.
Yeah. I couldn't agree with you more. Actually, we just did a proving of carcinosin in Japan. And we had a very similar experience to what you were describing in that, as you know, a lot of the information in the repertory in the Materia Medica is not from the provings but from clinical experience with the remedy. And a lot of the symptoms that came out in the proving, I mean, I was actually almost in a state of shock because there were things like, you know, palpitations from 2 to 6 p.m., and then we would look it up in the repertory, and there's the rubric with only carcinosin listed as a remedy. And, I mean, there were like maybe 10 different symptoms like that were very, very strange, rare, and peculiar, and carcinosin was the only remedy in the rubric. I mean, it was really quite astounding, and it really confirms, as you said, the scientific validity of this thing called provings that we do.
Yeah, well, look, mate, I'm excited to hear that. You know, was it last year? When was that Heidelberg, that big Lynx conference in Heidelberg?
Yeah, it's 2 years ago now, I believe.
2 years? Were you there?
I wasn't there, no, but I heard about it.
Vermeulen said this most amazing thing. It's really bizarre. Vermeulen said, you know what, we've got to be careful, you know, with a whole lot of these speculations and assertions about, you know, family and group and kingdom thinking.
Mm.
And one of the things he said, it just struck a chord. He says, take a remedy like tuberculinum. And then he went on and just talked about the provings of tuberculinum and bacillinum.
Mm.
And what I've been doing in the last couple of years is reproving bacillinum and tuberculinum. And now that you've done carcinosin, you know, we can, that's solid, you know. It creates some rigor in our science that sometimes isn't there. You know, we get all arty and we get a little bit excited sometimes, and some of the assertions that we make are just speculative. And I think it's exciting when you say that you've done a proving of carcinosin. I, you know, we all need to know about it.
Yeah. You know, I really appreciate what you're saying here, because I've felt for a long time now that in certain segments of the community that there's been a lack of scientific rigor, and it's really compromised some of the work that we're doing. And so it's wonderful, very refreshing to hear you say this. And
it has to be our future. You know, it's... You know, homeopathy is in trouble in some parts around the world. You know, I was talking to Susanna Shelton the other day. She runs a college in New Zealand. She says in her first year in London in 1984, there were 150 students in year one. Like, what's happened?
Yeah.
You know, I look around year one here, you know, and there's maybe 10, 15, 20, maybe 25 in the different colleges.
Yeah.
You know, I talk to Barbara in Colorado or go up to KL in Malaysia. And numbers, you know, it's just homeopathy is... for whatever reason, just struggling. And we cannot be publishing nonsense in the 21st century in an evidence-based world. We have to ground things in some rigor, in some method. You know, we need some evidence for some of those assertions we make. It's, for me, it's just, it has to be our future.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. So having said that, I know that you're involved in certain types of research, specifically into the practice of homeopathy. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure can. You might have to stop me, though, because I'll talk for hours.
You know, we might have to do another one of these calls in the very near future.
Not a problem.
A lot of very useful things to share. So.
Yeah. Well, look, I mean, it just started simply with me, you know, being asked to teach. I love teaching, and, you know, I love standing in front of a first-year class of homeopaths and talking and getting them excited about this amazing thing. But it's funny, you know, it's interesting to talk to the third years or the fourth years, you know, the ones that are coming out of college. And this bizarre thing happens to them. Somehow, some way, they lose their confidence and they lose, and it's worldwide. I teach a lot in Ireland. I've taught in England, in the States, in Asia, in Australia, New Zealand, all over. And students are not confidently running out into practice. They learn all of their homeopathic stuff. They learn Hahnemann's theory of chronic disease. You know, curriculums are different in different places. But why is it that we can't produce a student that is so excited about the use of these amazing remedies? What I constantly hear is, I'm not sure that I'm going to get it right.
Yeah.
Or I'm not crystal clear about which potency to use in this case. You know, fourth-year students and third-year students that I talk to that are in clinical training are hesitant and nervous and anxious, and I think that's just crazy. So over the years that I've just been interviewing them and trying to find out what it is that's going on and how is it that they adopt these attitudes when they clearly didn't have that attitude in first year or even second year.
Mm.
So, you know, you talk to a couple of hundred students or a couple of hundred graduates of homeopathy in different countries that are struggling to build their practices, good, competent homeopaths that are not busy, and they start to say the same things. And so over the, you know, I've been looking at a draft of a book that I've been working on getting busy in practice, you know, getting into thriving homeopathic practice and starting to look at those issues and research those issues about why some people make it and some people just clearly don't. And, you know, obviously there are consequences for our colleges and education institutions and different places that that are teaching homeopathy. And I started to especially wonder if we're teaching sometimes some pretty bad habits that have created the situation where good, solid homeopaths, they're just not pumping. Why is it that chiropractors run out of chiropractic school and they're just, you know, walking into meaningful businesses? Why is it that naturopaths in some countries are able to do that? Why is it that that the osteopathic college produces competent, confident graduates? And yet in homeopathy, sometimes that's just not what we seem to do.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's interesting because I have a similar experience, Alistair, and I know from talking to other people that maybe 10 to 15% of the people who graduate from homeopathy schools here in North America actually go on to have a successful, thriving practice. Mm-hmm. And I'm curious, what do you think is missing from these schools that's not allowing people to go out and, as you said, really be confident and go out and just start a practice and make it a successful one?
Well, there's many things, and some of them are practical, some of them are external, some of them are internal. You know, the external things are obvious, like in some states in the U.S., you know, it's very complicated to practice, you know.
Right, right.
There's other things, like, for example, it's really expensive to, you know, get a homeopathic pharmacy going. In some states or countries, you can't really advertise loudly about what it is you do. So there are some external problems as well.
Hmm.
But there are some internal things as well, and by internal I mean that there's some... I constantly see homeopaths blaming the outside when they're actually often tripping themselves up internally. I'm constantly stunned at the way that homeopaths advertise themselves.
Hmm.
I'm constantly stunned at the way that homeopaths attempt to talk to prospective clients. I'm stunned often by the fact that homeopaths get caught up in aspects of describing homeopathy that are intimidating and exclusive to folks that don't necessarily know a lot about homeopathy.
Hmm.
You know, when I often, as an exercise in some of my postgraduate courses, just get students to talk about their perceptions of homeopathy and what it is. And the first thing they talk about is miasms or Hahnemann or chronic disease. And those words are off limits when you're talking to someone in the public. Do you know what I mean? And so, you know, when you're describing homeopathy, it's a marketing nightmare in the 21st century, even the word itself.
Mm.
So, you know, I encourage my students, undergraduate and postgraduate, to start thinking about ways in which they can creatively add energy or pitch the information that they have to a prospective client or in print or verbally, so that it can be heard and so that it's not intimidating. We've all had that situation where people, you know, walk away or go cross-eyed when we start to describe homeopathy. But I think we have to do something about that. So I train any student or, you know, anyone that shows up to my seminars, we have a good talk about how to describe what homeopathy is in the 21st century.
Mm.
I mean, you know what it's like. Some of the folks that I'm talking to in my first-year classes in homeopathy are Generation Y. Well, they want an explanation about homeopathy that they can download on their iPod, you know, or that they can grasp really simply.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that we just get a little bit exclusive sometimes in homeopathy, or we forget that because we've been involved in this industry for 20 years, we think we can talk like that in the general domain and expect that those clients will flood to us.
Mm-hmm.
That's another feature that I really think work can be done on to build practice.
Mm-hmm.
However, the biggest thing of all is confidence. And one of the biggest things of all, and this is, I don't want to get into any trouble, but I think students and recent graduates get very, very caught up on this idea of suppression. And they worry about, you know, messing with people's health and, oh, my God, if I get it wrong, then I can really do some damage to this patient's health. And, you know, it's. I think this comes through very heavily in Kent's work and Vithulkas's work.
Mm.
And to my way of thinking and my experience, it's not a reality if you've got those fundamental homeopathic skills. And for some reason, this is also something that I've had lots and lots of feedback from those students that really struggle, is that they really worry about messing with somebody's health at a deep level if they give the wrong remedy. And I'm not a fan of that at all. Hahnemann, of course, you know, he there was no such thing. I mean, homeopathy was about prescribing a close similar, and you work your way to cure over a period of time.
Yeah.
And for some reason, you know, homeopaths somehow keep talking about that magic bullet. Yeah. And it's just not a reality.
Yeah. It's interesting. It's an interesting contrast between Hahnemann and Kent. You know, you've got those aphorisms, I think 172 through 181, where he talks about not being enough remedies, and you're going to give a remedy that's fairly close and move the case forward and then retake the case. And yet Kent makes, and as you said, Vatulkas as well, make a big issue about if you don't give that right remedy. It's an interesting contrast between those two points of view.
You see, I mean, it's just fundamental. If I'm a fan of Kent. I was taught Kentian homeopathy at college, and that's what I thought homeopathy was for the first 5, even 10 years of my practice. But those aphorisms you just mentioned, they take all of the anxiety out of homeopathy as a practitioner.
I think so, too.
It's just amazing. Hahnemann says, do your best.
Yeah.
Get as close as you can, and if it's not perfect, then add in those new auxiliary symptoms and prescribe the next best remedy.
Totally.
It's just
it makes
simple.
It easy, for sure, yep.
I'm just stunned that, you know, people are still so worried about, oh, my God, I have to get it right.
Yeah.
Actually, it's a consequence. I don't believe that Rajan actually says it, but it is a consequence of some of the work that he's been doing and publishing, that it does perpetuate this idea of, you know, there is the perfect golden remedy and I have to nail it, and if I don't, I'm a bad person and the homeopathic police will come along and beat me up. Do you know what I mean?
I love it. I love what you shared. I'm totally on the same page with you.
I'd like
to move on because we're running a little bit short on time. I'd like to give some of the people on the call an opportunity to ask you some questions. You obviously have a tremendous background in homeopathy and a lot to share. I'm curious. I know that you're doing a thesis, and I'm curious if you could just share a little bit about the thesis and what's coming out of that.
Yeah, sure. Not a problem at all. Well, look, it's different now because I've written it and it's gone and published, and I even got a pass for it. What I've done over the last couple of years is I took myself back to college, and I've done the Masters of Science through the University of Lancashire in England. And I tell you what, I mean, I thought I knew a lot about homeopathy, but that course was just magic. And the piece of research that I did to finish off that course was a piece of research on interviewing thriving and busy and successful homeopaths around the world. And what I've done is I've put that together, used a qualitative research tool that, you know, those academics are happy with. And what I've done is, you know, knocked up what I think is a pretty solid piece of work about those qualities that are required if you really want to make a fist of this thing in homeopathy, and especially if you want to, you know, run a thriving practice. And so, you know, there's a number of bullet points to hit in terms of conclusions from that research, and some surprising things. And, of course, the major one is that you don't necessarily need to be a good technical prescriber to be a thriving practitioner. But what you do need to be or have is a way of making meaningful contact with your clients through a deep therapeutic relationship. You know, that's as important, if not more important, than being technically correct. You know, I tell my students, look, you know, the keynotes of Pulsatilla are in the book. But, you know, shut up and listen to your client and really listen to them. You know, that's the kind of approach that I have. And I think it's been borne out by that research as well.
Mm.
And the more sobering thing that's come out of that research is that there's one common ingredient amongst thriving practitioners around the world. And that is that they had to make it happen, you know. There's an aspect of tenacity and perseverance and almost desperation, actually, that's at the core of thriving practitioners of homeopathy, especially at the beginning, in those beginning years. I was really surprised by that. But every busy homeopath I talked to said the same thing. In the early years when they were building their practice, one of the reasons it was so busy and so successful is they had to make it happen. There was the mortgage or the kids or the, you know, the wolf at the door.
Well, this sounds like really fascinating reading. Is it? How can somebody have access to this? Is it available someplace? Or?
Well, I've got my editor onto it at the moment, and I'm desperately trying to knock it out as a useful, but yet well-researched book. I'm about maybe a month away from that process. So, look, my intention is to have that in a formal, in book form real quick. The actual thesis itself, I was just looking at my website, and it's not up there. So I'm going to attach the thesis itself to my website, and So, you know, folks can read that and see what they think about it. And I think it's also been published. Hang on just a moment. No. That's right. I had to just remind myself. That's another article I've written for the journal in the UK. But anyway, that thesis itself, you know, watch this space, and it'll be available pretty soon.
Fantastic. Now, you were talking about thriving practitioners as the central theme of your thesis, and I'm curious, in your opinion, like, what qualities does a 21st century homeopath have to have to really make it these days?
Yeah, right. Okay, it's a great question, and of course, we've got to be a little careful here, because of course, thriving doesn't necessarily mean I make a lot of money, and thriving, you know, doesn't necessarily mean I'm busy 5 days a week. And actually, thriving doesn't mean that homeopathy needs to be full-time. I've talked to plenty of amazing homeopaths that are busy, that are working 3 days a week and, you know, doing other things with their time. But I think thriving does mean things like earning the majority of their income through homeopathy, or, you know, the significant amount of their time and energy is devoted to homeopathy. So that just needs to be said about the word thriving. But I don't know about you, but I look in my electronic database that I have, and I'm just bewildered and inundated with the amount of information that is available. We've got every journal that's ever been written, and everybody's publishing new books and all the rest of it. And so, to answer your question, the crucial quality of the 21st century homeopath is you've got to be able to manage information. Mm. It's actually not that you've got to be a brilliant prescriber. It's about knowing where information is.
Yeah.
And this is a feature of the last 10 years of the planet, really, isn't it? Because there's just too much information for us all to be able to deal with. So that's the first thing. We've got to be able to manage information really, really well. I think the next quality is you've got to be flexible. And I'm a total fan of people running off to Rajan or Jan Schulten or different, you know, really different experts and getting to grips with you know, new ideas and new method. But I have to say I've got one really strong opinion, and I'm firmly of the belief that undergraduate students should not necessarily be exposed to that, because it creates a lot of confusion and it really undermines the grounding and the simplicity of homeopathy, of especially that Bernhardshausen method. So I think for me, you know, if you're in the 21st century and you want to practice homeopathy, you know, you put your feet in the ground, learn solid day-to-day, you know, simple homeopathy, Bernhardshausen style, and then put that extra exciting stuff on top. I think that's really important that it happens in that order. Otherwise, we get some pretty ungrounded stuff going on.
You know, and I see there's actually precedent for it. I know you're probably familiar with the history of it, but in 1864, when Lippe took over the Homeopathic Medical College of Pennsylvania, and he basically instituted a program of Hahnemannian homeopathy. You know, you couldn't, you know, and he was like really rigid about it, maybe even more so than was necessary, but you know, he really imposed the system on all levels, you know, the teaching of pathology, everything else. And the result basically was the people who graduated during that 5-year period went on to be the best practitioners in the history of homeopathy. And so I think, yeah, it's great. We need to be open. As Herring said, we need to go beyond the study and practice that Hahnemann did. But at the same time, if we don't have that foundation in the classics, I think, as you said correctly, we get very confused. And I see it a lot in North America when I travel around, people just very confused about what homeopathy even is. So
yeah, I cannot. I mean, we're definitely on the same page.
Yeah.
And I don't know, you know, it's just a consequence, really, of some of those new and exciting ideas of homeopathy being taught to undergraduate people that don't have their feet in the ground, or they're rooted in the repertory and rooted in Bernhardshausen method or Hahnemannian method, and it's a sad consequence, and it has to be. You know, I'm with the focus on that one. I do believe that one of the reasons for the problems that homeopathy has at the moment is because of you know, that ungrounded information being taught to folks that aren't really necessarily ready for it.
Mm-hmm. You know, Alistair, what the homeopath does in some respects is different from what other practitioners do. What qualities and skills do you feel that homeopaths have to have that are different or not consistent with, you know, your general practitioner out there?
Yeah, right. Here's what I reckon. One of the things that's that I've noticed about really solid homeopaths is that they engage with the medicines in some way. You know, there's a relationship that they have with the actual substances, plants. They prove them, or they grow them, or they go and dig them up, or they swim with them. You know, there's just something that I've noticed that homeopaths often end up doing, and that's something visceral that they engage with those medicines. In addition to that, there's, you know, I suppose what I want to say really is that I really advocate that people get away from this idea that you've got to be technically perfect or have all of those amazing materia medica knowledge in homeopathy. And so because of that, I think that one of the reasons that I've done pretty well with the work that I do is because I know how to engage with people. I know how to contact them. I'm a better listener than I am a technical homeopath. And so I think those qualities that you learn, or that skill that you learn from other disciplines, you might learn it from psychotherapy, or you might learn it from meeting people in the cafe, or you might, you know, those things that you bring to the homeopathic table from your other world are as important as the things you necessarily learn in college.
Mm-hmm. Very interesting. Alistair, I know that you're doing something called the Fusion course. Can you tell us a little bit about that? What is actually going on with that?
Sure. Look, in many years ago in New Zealand, essentially through what I've just been saying, through the hearing the frustrations of recent graduates and wanting to make a difference in our industry and homeopaths in general, I decided to fill what I perceived to be the gap of education in these parts. Pretty much inspired by Jeremy Scher, but then I realized that the gap in Australia and New Zealand when it comes to homeopathy is significantly different. And so I put together a postgrad course. It's developed and evolved as we've gone, and I like to take medium to small size groups through a process that usually takes place over a year. So it's a postgrad course. People show up to Sydney or Auckland or Brisbane this year, and what we do is talk about some of the issues that we've discussed today. We do some technical aspects of homeopathy, but we get really clear about one thing, and that busy, thriving homeopaths are not just intellectually brilliant. They're grounded. They are passionate and fiery as well. As much as that they're earthy and grounded, they're passionate, and of course that they're great listeners as well. So they've got those elements, especially the marriage of the elements of air and water and fire and earth, you know, that they are all-rounders. And I attempt to, if there is an education gap or a gap in people's confidence, then I attempt to fill it with a program that I've put together. I'm also working on putting that as much as I can online and then supporting it with intensives, you know, maybe a 4 or 5 day workshop that I can take on the road so that people could do some study at home, listen to some or watch some PowerPoints, listen to some lectures and all the rest of it, and then meet in different places. And so that's something that I've been wanting to take to Asia, and we'll see, maybe the States as well.
And any other projects that you're working on currently, Alistair, that you'd like to share with?
Sure, my lord. You know,
I know it's an open-ended question.
I've got my hands on my head at the moment because there's quite a lot on. I'm working on this book on thriving practice, which I really want to get out. That's the first thing. I've got a piece of research that I want to complete on men and treating male patients, and I think that will be valuable for the homeopathic community. And because of the amount of cases that I've got a book that's on the go at the moment on treating people that are struggling with recreational drug use, and that is a problem in the Western world, and it makes it for a big obstacle to cure in the treatment by homeopathy sometimes, and I think some practitioners make some mistakes actually when they're doing that. So I'd like to make a contribution in that area as well. Geez, there's a couple of provings that are going on at the moment as well. And so I'm looking at my desk and there's a bunch of stuff piling up. Yeah, there's a lot on.
Well, that's fantastic. And I'm particularly, I mean, excited about the work on recreational drug use, because that is a huge problem in the West. And I know even now I was reading an article, Alistair, that Russia and Iran are experiencing huge amounts of drug use. So this is,
yep,
this is something that's spreading throughout the world. And boy, you know, we certainly need some good material on it, so that sounds really exciting.
Well, doesn't it? It takes us back to that discussion just before about Lippe and Hahnemann and Bernieghausen, because clearly, if you're working with someone that's really struggling, that maybe on cannabis or something else like that, you know, the magic bullet is a possibility, but it's just so much harder to get to.
Mm.
So you've got to work with those people and work towards, educating them as well as, you know, curing them with that perfect similimum. And so obviously those aphorisms you spoke about before, for me that's just what I do daily, you know. I'm working with people heading towards a direction, and, often it's a journey together. I'm learning as much as they are.
Fantastic. Alistair, if people want to get more information about where you're teaching or your books or provings, is there a website or a contact number that they can reach, get more information from?
Yeah, sure. What they can do, I've got a it's a kind of a eccentric little website, which is grayhomeopathy.com, gray with an A, and homeopathy, H-O-M-E-O.
So G-R-A-Y homeopathy.com.
Yeah.
Okay, good.
And information there on provings or where I'm teaching. At the moment I'm interviewing an assistant to try and, it's hard to find people that are into homeopathy that have got a web background, but I'm trying to develop that site so that it's much more user-friendly. And I teach predominantly at Endeavour College of Natural Health in Australia, and that's a pretty exciting development in the world of education as well. So people can look up that online, Endeavour College of Natural Health. And then they can contact me, Alistair, at grayhomeopathy.com.
Okay,
great. I'm more than happy to chat, talk. There's so much to talk about, isn't there?
Oh, fantastic. And I hope you will come back for another one of these, because I have got some other questions I'm dying to ask you, but I'd like to give some other people an opportunity. So would you consider coming back for a future call? And
yeah, of course.
No, that would be wonderful. We'd love to have you back. So let me go ahead and open it up to the we've got about 6-7 minutes left. So is there anybody on who would like to ask Alistair Gray a question about homeopathy?
I would just like to make a comment, if I could. This is Caitlin from Escondido, California.
Caitlin, welcome. Thank you.
Thank you. I just want to tell you, Alistair, I'm so grateful for you mentioning the idea of students feeling lacking confidence when they leave, because I was one of those students, and I graduated about 2 years ago, but I didn't. I had to fight against that lack of confidence. I mean, it was really difficult, but I now have practiced this building, but it's been a tough road to hoe.
Isn't it just, Caitlin, that's just fantastic. I mean, and that's a comment that I've heard over and over again, and it drives me to despair that such an enthusiastic, competent practitioner struggles to really get pumping in their practice. I just, you know, it's, why is that? And, it's something that I want to make a difference with. And, confidence is built brick by brick, really, isn't it? Often it's just case by case by case, and that win and that win and that win. 2 steps forward, 1 back, 3 forward, 2 back. And, hang in there, and, tenacity and persistence is a quality that so many successful homeopaths have told me that they have.
That's what you have to have. But there was, you know, you left with the fear of God, exactly what you said, that, you know, you do the wrong thing, and that's it. You can potentially ruin somebody. And if you don't get the right remedy right off the bat, you could confuse the case, and then you're lost and doomed, and that's it. You're done for.
I know. The focus puts the fear of God into us, doesn't he?
Yes.
Kent did the same thing. And it's just, you know, like, I totally respect both of those authors, and some of their work is just magnificent. But that one particular point I cannot agree with, and I really think it's been the downfall of many a potentially great homeopath, and it drives me to despair.
Thank you.
Thank
you.
Other
questions for Alistair Gray? You've got somebody on who's got a lot to share, a lot of wisdom, a lot of insights into homeopathy, so this is a good opportunity to ask your questions.
Well, if no one else, if I could ask another question.
Please,
if no one
go
else
ahead.
Could take it. It's Caitlin again.
Mm-hmm.
Did someone want to say something?
Go ahead, Caitlin.
Okay. About recreational drugs. Actually, I have a client right now who is I've given her Natrum Muriaticum. She came to my office really depressed, almost hardly able to function with anxiety and pretty almost agoraphobic. And I gave her Natrum Mur and actually brought her right out, but she is hooked on cannabis.
Mm.
And she smokes every night.
Mm.
And I don't know. I mean, I'm continuing to give her Natrum Mur, but I don't know. Will the Natrum Mur eventually take such strong hold that she'll eventually automatically not feel the need to repeat the use of pot?
Yeah, that's a great question. And the answer is I don't think it is. Natrum Mur. You know, when you talk to a lot of people that smoke dope, you got to remember something, that cannabis is something like 14 times stronger than it was in the 60s, especially with that hydroponic stuff that they grow.
Yeah.
And that means that it's extremely powerful and toxic. And while it might be fun, you know, when you're 17, you know, you do that for 10 years and you've got a really toxic system. One of the things that is clear to me is you've got to get to the reason why people smoke. And with cannabis, it's really interesting because often it's boredom. Often it's because I can't sleep at night. And often it's because of clairvoyance. And it's a way to dampen down all of that exquisite, strong sensitivity. You know, when you really start questioning people as to why they do their compulsive behaviors, that's eating or food or cannabis or chocolate or heroin or whatever it might be, you've really got to nail as much as you can the reason. What's going on when they reach for that substance? What's going on in that moment? And if you can really understand what's going on, really question her about what's going on when you just start to light that bong or whatever it is that she's doing, and really understand in that moment, then you've got an insight into the next layer and you might well be able to unravel it from the inside out. But one other thing, remember you've got all of that amazing work from James Compton Burnett. Now, that homeopath, amazing homeopath from England in the 1800s, remember he gave us a whole lot of gems around organ prescribing. And sometimes when you're trying to find that beautiful similimum, you can assist someone by just gently detoxifying them or working on an organ support level as you're trying to get that... as you're trying to work towards that central information. So sometimes you can support people as you're trying to get that golden information that maybe you can't get at the first or second or third or tenth consultation.
And who is this? I've not. Can you tell me how to spell?
Yeah, Burnett, B-U-R-N-E-T-T, James Compton Burnett. Probably the best book to read if you want to get into his work is Ian Watson's book, that little green book by Ian Watson called The Guide to the Methodologies of Homeopathy. He describes just a little chapter, maybe 5 pages. He talks about Compton Burnett's work. I've had some nice results using that.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Well, I can see that, unfortunately, we're out of time because obviously we could spend hours and hours asking Alistair, great questions with wonderful responses. He's been very gracious and said that he will come back and do another interview with us again. I want to personally thank you for taking the time out of your very busy life and your productive work for homeopathy to share with us. And if everybody on the call can give Alistair Gray a big thank you, that would be wonderful.
Thank you, Alistair.
Thank you so much.
Cheers. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Alistair, and we'll talk soon.